Schools across America face an increasingly diverse student population, while deep-seated institutional biases endure. Today's guest argues that successful leaders who dig deep and unpack their own experiences with race and bias can help tear down the barriers of institutional racism. She's Darnisa Amate this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. We do that by visiting each week with the best contemporary storytellers, authors, scholars, filmmakers, and more, really anyone using or studying narrative to explain the world around us. This week, we're joined by Dr. Darnisa Amate, an educational and racial equity strategist who is deeply committed to the study of culture, innovation, and adult development. She is founder and the CEO of the Disruptive Equity Education Project, or DEEP, based in Manchester, New Hampshire. Darnisa, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So we want to talk a little bit about your work, but tell us about the journey that led you to the work that you're doing with DEEP.
I think the funniest part of the journey is, by trade, I'm actually an anthropologist. And a lot of folks don't usually know that. So I got my master's in sociocultural anthropology. I was fascinated by the study of culture, by the study of people, and changing culture. And when I graduated from college, I kind of looked up and said, what am I going to do with this now? A lot of people actually say that. And I found that the last 15 years has really been applied anthropology. I went into education. I worked in after-school programs. I started a tutoring and test prep organization. And then when I finally stepped into schools, I saw something that I didn't see in the after-school space. You know, in after-school, what you see are the rippling effects of what may or may not be happening in classrooms. I realized I didn't really have empathy for teachers back then, because every time I would see students, all I would see were students with these large gaps in their learning, things that they just didn't understand, and I felt this sense of responsibility from the after-school space to understand more of what was happening in schools. And so I said, okay, I'm gonna become a classroom teacher. I'm gonna commit to really supporting students in classrooms. And within one day, I realized that my whole narrative about what classrooms were was completely wrong.
Explain that for us.
So I find that as a teacher, you really have control over your classroom, but you don't control how the institution functions. So you could be in a classroom that is doing amazing things while working within a building where you have no ability to change any practices, any policies, or the ways that other teachers are teaching. And it was this feeling both of empowerment and disempowerment at the same time.
And was it that experience that led you to create DEEP?
It was a part of it, because I said, well, if it's not teachers, then maybe it's principals. And I didn't want to be a principal. I think the principalship is the hardest job in all of education. So I lift up all my principal friends and colleagues. And then when I started supporting principals as a coach, I realized it wasn't principals either. And then I said, well, maybe it's the superintendent. And I started supporting superintendents. And I realized that education in and of itself is steeped in inequity, that almost everyone at every level feels disempowered, that everyone wants to make foundational changes for children, for families, for community. And it's really possible to feel like your hands are tied at every single level. And I started saying, if we really wanted to systemically dismantle education, at least the inequity within education, what exactly would that take? And so it was the first time in all of those years I put my anthropology hat on. I said, what this is a call to action for cultural change. This is systemically building new culture and giving people examples of what a new end goal for education could be. We still question what the purpose of education is. But education is actually functioning very well. It is a system that was created to be inequitable. It was created to sort students. It was created to identify who would be our workforce and who would be the leaders of that workforce. And while the whole history of education isn't nefarious, it is very much built in that purpose. And I said, who would have to do the disruption? Who would have to show some new skills to have a new way? And as I thought back to what I thought some of my best skills were as an anthropologist, it was listening to people. It was hearing multiple perspectives. It was allowing people to have care for each other as we talked about really difficult things. And I didn't feel like I could work within education and disrupt it. It's almost like the Matrix, right? Just like from the film, The Matrix.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to step outside of the system to disrupt it, but you still have to have one foot in the door of the system to understand enough about it to change it.
Wow.
And that's how DEEP was born. It's this external, internal push on change.
So you talk about changing mindsets around equity and dismantling systemic oppression and racism. It's a big challenge, clearly. Talk about systemic oppression. What do you mean when you use that term?
So when I think of systemic oppression, I think that's a great question. The way that I tend to think about it are the overlapping of different institutions and structures. So it's really the combination of multiple sectors that are creating policies and practices that are oppressing or marginalizing people. And it's not only because of race. Inequity is as broad as it is specific. But it was really thinking about what are the systems in this country? What are the policies in this country? What are the ways in which we think about groups, right? Our own bias that contribute to us creating more policies and more practices that just continue to oppress and marginalize people. And the oppression for me is maybe not being seen in your own identity, having people not believe your lived experiences when you share them. Oppression could be wanting to have access to opportunities and resources, and there's a physical barrier there that prevents you from doing what you believe you must do. And so I think about it on all those different levels.
So that applies to all races.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming from white to African American to Latino to Asian American, and also immigrants. I know you research and do some work with immigrants. I mean, those people would fit in that category as well, would they not?
Yes. And I think that's the way I think about equity almost in two different levels. And I think it's important to make the distinction. The first one is that oppression and systemic oppression, I believe, comes for all of us. I don't think anyone's free from it. But I think the way you live, the way in which you've been oppressed can look different for different groups. So I think about socioeconomic status. I think about ableism. I think about non-able-bodied communities, right? Those who have invisible and visible disabilities. I'm thinking about gender. The fact that gender is not a binary, but a lot of our ideology tells us it is. Right, so those are the type of inequities broadly, as well as citizenship, right, your status in this country. But then there's something called racial equity. And this is where the distinction happens. It's, I can understand that all these inequities are happening, but the minute you intersect inequity with race, something happens. And I know a lot of people say, if race is a social construct, if we made it up, why should you give value to it? Why should you talk about it? And the real reason is if we don't talk about it, you can't understand my lived experiences in the world. Race is not real, but racism is. And when you don't talk about race, you can't talk about the racism that I have experienced on a daily basis. And so the racial equity is understanding that the darker you get in this country, the more disproportionate your experiences of inequity are.
You so say the darker, you mean the color of your
skin. The color of your skin.
Right.
Like skin color actually really does matter in this country.
Yes.
There have been studies about this.
That's right.
Yeah.
There are a lot of studies, and it's just, it's the darker you get, the more disproportionate your experiences of inequity are. So if I had to compare, right, and if I was just thinking about, let's say, transgendered communities, right, I know that being transgender doesn't matter what race you are, but it is there are a group of folks who are often experiencing marginalization and oppression. But the minute I overlay race on top of that. It changes the dynamic, and you start to see that Black and brown, transgendered communities are 8 times more likely to be killed than white communities.
And that's not a coincidence.
That is a coincidence.
A relationship between the color of skin and the prevailing
mentality.
And
it's also what we've been taught to believe about different groups of people. There's a very prevalent ideology in this country around who we believe is safe and who isn't, who's aggressive and who isn't, who gets to be vulnerable and who doesn't, which children get to be successful, and which ones do we write off when they walk in our door.
And a lot of those beliefs are forged, obviously, in the culture, but also in schools.
That's right.
Which is where your most profound work comes in.
Is that why you chose to focus on schools?
Yeah. Schools, for me, I think it was two different reasons. One, as a child growing up in Brooklyn and East New York, I felt like I saw some of the best and worst examples of what can happen when you have an influx of drugs in your community. And there are many people in the community that I grew up where education was the way. It was the way that we were taught to excel. It was the way that we were taught to get out, whatever that means. And it was this real vehicle for change, even
in my own life. Well, it was a way to live a fuller and more meaningful life.
That's right. And so because of how much education changed my experience, how much it changed the experiences in the world for my family, I felt a due diligence to give back. And it was once I was in the space, I realized that education is the way in which we inculcate future generations. You reteach the ideology. You recenter certain cultures. You decenter other cultures. And I deeply believe one of the biggest challenges we'll face in education is what's not there versus what is there.
Meaning what?
The absence of content and curriculum is still messaging something.
And these are lessons that have application to all classrooms.
That's right.
Not simply classrooms in parts of Baltimore or where you have large concentrations of African Americans or on a Native American reservation, for example. This is all classrooms.
This is all classrooms, and it's all types of learners. So it's not just, so DEEP doesn't just work with the pre-K through 12 space. We also work with institutes of higher learning, and we just work with adults who are in community. Education is a vehicle to disrupt mindset.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. We're delighted to join you 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States channel. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkable and talented team at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis, Executive Director of the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in historic Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, I'm at J.M. Lutis. Joining me, as always, is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller, an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. He's also the author of 17 books. You can connect with him on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week is Darnisa Amante, the CEO of the Disruptive Equity Education Project, which works with school districts across the country to change mindsets around equity and dismantle systemic oppression and racism. Dr. Amante is on Twitter at DLAMANTE.
If it's leveraged well. Now, I think that people have a right to believe what they believe, right? Like, that's one of the things that's most foundationally important, I think, about this country. So I'm not suggesting that people have to have a particular belief, but I think what has happened is people's perspectives and mindsets have been narrowed. People don't actually have access to content. We live more segregated than we have ever lived before. In this country right now, you can live, eat, breathe, sleep, and die with the same cultural group and racial group as yourself. If you don't learn about difference in school, there is no place to learn about it.
And social media, of course, has simply amplified that
difference.
The word silo or isolation or just in your own group.
You used a word just now. You talked about disrupting a mindset. You're the Disruptive Equity Education Project. The disruption that you're trying to achieve is what precisely?
I think that's a great question. Thanks so much. I think of disruption really as approaching something that people have approached before in a non-traditional way. And one of the things that I realized very early on when DEEP was founded was equity is one of those words that's as amorphous as love. Everyone's experience with the word is based, everyone's definition of the word is actually based off of their experience. So when you tell some people, I love you, that's the worst possible thing that you can say to them. And equity, when you say, I want to be equitable, I want to engage in equity, it was a term that some people thought meant equality. For some people, they thought equity was your house. It was how much equity did you have in your home? And so for just baseline.
For your mortgage.
That's right. Yeah. They're like, what's so bad about having equity? Yeah. I'm like, oh, no.
Why would you want to disrupt
what I have, the type
to get
of
a lower interest rate.
That's right. And so it was just really disrupting the conventional way that we had heard people talk about equity. And I think it's also disrupting that equity work does not synonymously equate to you being called a racist or being called ignorant. Equity is one of those words that triggers people because as soon as they hear it, they say, are you going to tell me I'm not woke enough? I'm not conscious enough? Am I going to be blamed for what I don't know? I didn't know I had to know. And I don't want anybody to think I'm not a good person. Like, I wanted people to disrupt the fact that this is going to be uncomfortable work, but it's not intentionally trying to make people feel terrible about themselves. It's a call to action. It's a reckoning that in order for us to be the type of society we say we are, we have to listen to the perspectives of those we both agree and don't agree with. That you really have to understand through storytelling how people are living in this country, because education right now is not teaching that. Yeah. It's not saying, here's the compilation of the United States, and did you know that you can still be racially profiled in this country. You can still be told that you're not intelligent because of the color of your skin. You can still have people assume you're a thug or whatever it may be just because of how you're dressed. That there's real perspectives on both sides of that story, and education is not normally the place where we share stories like that. And to me, all of that was the disruption. That storytelling and conversations are the work. In education and in any professional development field, we're often taught that the work is a product. It's some one thing that you're going to have after engaging in work for multiple years. And the disruption for me is equity is a process. It's a process of learning how to talk to people. It's a process of learning how to agree to disagree again. It's a process of expanding heart and mind and soul and being empathetic. And it's a process of a collective commitment to dismantle policies and practices that will continue to oppress even long after we're gone if they're not brought down.
Is equity too about giving everybody's story the same value?
So I think of equity as more, right? And I know this is a harder part of the conversation because equity feels very fixed, right? We do have a fixed table. I wish we could invite everyone to the table, but the way I like to think of it is equity is understanding, first, that there are systems of oppression and that those systems create policies and practices that make it impossible for certain groups to achieve or to be as successful without support. It doesn't mean communities of color are lazy. It doesn't mean that we want a handout. It just means that there are real institutions that we do not have systemic power to dismantle.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, so I think of, there's so many. I wish there weren't so many. So I'm speaking from a personal lived experience. One of those examples I'll start with is ideology, right? It's just the belief that certain people have about Black communities. And so there's a very pervasive belief. And I wouldn't say it's beyond the United States. I can't speak globally, but at least here, that Black women are angry, that we're aggressive, that we can't be vulnerable. And so any way that I present, I have to show up always genteel, in a very calm voice, even though I might not be angry. The perception of my voice when I'm excited could get me fired. Could get me kicked out of a room. And I have personal agency to tell people that's not who I am. That's not how we are broadly. But I can't go and create a policy or practice or embed some new institution from the government down to help people to understand that Black women are not volatile or angry. Another one is my hair. So for everyone on the show, you can see my hair is pretty long. And so I've found that a part of that ideology has often lifted up that hair should be straight, that the most beautiful hair is normally sleek and it's smooth. And so people who have curly hair, or people who have hair like mine, which is locked or just natural, my hair's got some volume to it. I know they slicked it back a little bit today, but it's usually got some volume on it. And because it's so different, because we've been taught that beautiful hair is straight, people touch me all the time. They touch my hair.
Really?
All the time, daily.
You mean like strangers? And
strangers? Okay, planes, trains, automobiles.
Really?
Walking,
really?
Power walking and jogging. I have run a half marathon and had somebody run their full hands through my hair while running a half marathon, okay? So it's not because people are bad people. It's because we don't actually know that to do that could be hurtful to me. And so how does this turn into systemic policy and practice? Yeah. There's now law in the country as of last year that says that I can be fired from a job for having hair like this.
Really?
It is a real policy in this country that says that hair is a choice. And that if I choose to wear my hair like this, then I am essentially choosing to not have a job should my employer not want it. And that is fully legal.
It's a federal law?
I'm not sure if it's federal or state, but it is a law somewhere.
Wow.
And so this is what I mean when I say that I didn't create that. But my whole life experience now, I'm going to have to wake up. And if I was applying to a job, if I wasn't an entrepreneur, if I wasn't the president of Deep, I would have to wonder, am I going to get a job today? How should I wear my hair to this interview? Should I cover my hair so that they don't know what it really looks like? And it's not that people of color can't push back on those laws. But really, in this country, white communities tend to have the most institutional power, the systemic power to change the policy. That's why partnership across difference is so important, because until just now, you didn't know that.
Yeah.
But now that you know it, you can get as enraged as I am about it.
I think that's a great example, because before bringing up that example, it's something I never would have thought about.
That's right.
I mean, I've written about and I understand a lot about institutional racism and structural racism in terms of the economy and jobs. And But this is a little more subtle, and yet it's really not subtle. I mean, if it's in your head and could actually deny you a job, that's not subtle.
And the thing I think I appreciate about the use of the word subtle, I never ask, why did it feel subtle to you, but it doesn't feel subtle to me? The disruptive approach is, I'm wondering why you didn't even know that that was happening. Like, that's the type of work that I'm doing, which is around the extension of care. I'm not angry that you didn't know.
Yeah.
But it's, I need all of us to be asking the critical question about why we didn't know that.
So sort of the old-fashioned term here is consciousness racism.
That's right.
I mean, that's really what we're talking about, because you just raised my consciousness on that issue.
And I told you a story.
Yeah.
And that's the power of storytelling. No adult, no child wants to feel like you're coming to them with a book to just load some content on them that doesn't feel applicable.
Bunch of numbers and they are all important, but it's what our show is about, the power of story.
And I know you probably know this better than I. There are only two things in the whole world that can keep an adult's attention span. One of them is a purpose. It's a rationale, a rhyme, or a reason. And the other one's a story. That's why adults lean in when you tell really good stories. And I don't mean for the performance of it, but when you open your heart and share something that hurts for the greater good of consciousness raising. And in my role, I am normally telling a lot of my stories because I don't expect people of color to play that role in any room. A big ask on us is to often be the experts as we are simultaneously being traumatized while doing the work. I don't know how to explain, like, most people have never seen a black woman in my complexion in leadership. Most men have especially never seen it. And then I'm from Brooklyn. I'm from this place that people have said demography was supposed to write off. And then I have a doctorate from Harvard, and what does that even mean? And then I walk in the room, and people are just still trying to believe that this dark-skinned black woman from Brooklyn could be a doctor from Harvard, not even talking about my content. Like, the general disbelief that I am who I am just rolls with folks for multiple hours, right? It is just, it's that. It's
so where do you have a gift for storytelling? And we've long established on this show that story is so fundamental. It goes back to cave times. It's hardwired into our brains. Where did your gift for storytelling come from?
My grandparents.
And
my both sets. So my dad's mom, Elizabeth Ann, I always like to say her name. She's since left us. She left us in 2008. And then my mom's parents, Carolyn and Lance. I was raised by my grandparents, and one of the things that I loved was my grandparents realized really early on that I loved people. They didn't know what about people, but I was always interested. I was like, tell me more, tell, you know, young Darnie said, tell me more.
Tell me a story.
That's right. PBS, right? So I grew up watching a lot of PBS as well, and it was always storytelling. And my grandfather has experienced a lot of history and is himself a historian. He won't tell you he is. And he knew when I was a kid, I would just watch the History Channel all the time. And he would say, you want to hear something about how I lived? And he and my grandma, for my entire life, almost every day of my life, told me a different story about their experiences in segregation, about what it was like migrating from the South up to the North, what it was like traveling through Jim Crow South, what it was like trying to get a job, how much their first apartment cost. You know, hearing my grandmother talk about her first paycheck from the government, she used to work for the feds, her first paycheck, she's like, yeah, $6,000 a year. And I'm just like, what? And it was just, it was something, I can never forget the stories, because once they told me the stories, it put everything else in context. And I realized that they knew that that was how I connected with the world. And I found that I would just gravitate to anything where people were just sharing. That's the best learning I've ever had in my life. And it's the naturally voyeuristic part of us. I'm not afraid to say it. Good stories tell you a lot about people.
Journalists, right? I always have to explain.
And then when the story gets really, really good, you're like, oh? It's the voyeurism of it all, right? It's like, if you're willing to share, I'm willing to listen.
Well, we're thrilled that you shared all of this with us.
Absolutely.
Today.
Thank you.
Darnisa Amate, thank you so much for being with us. She is Darnisa Amate with the Disruptive Equity Education Project. It's a mouthful, I gotta work on it. That's all the time we have this week, but if you wanna know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can also catch up on previous episodes. He's G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.